Director Lopez? Anne, would you like to call roll call?
Here.
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 All right. With that, this is our opportunity for public comment. If there's anybody in the audience that'd like to address the board on items that are not on the agenda, we'd love to hear from them. Okay, so seeing none, we'll jump into reports. At this point in time, there is no report for the Budget, Personnel, and Nominating Committee because we didn't have one. So we'll move on to the Advisory Committee. Rich?
There was no meeting this month. There will be one next month.
Okay, can't wait. So at this time, any referrals or comments from board members? Anybody would like to announce something or share any good news? Now would be the time. I would just share, I had a great meeting with Senator Monty. Thank you, Rich, for just everything you had to share. So I recapped the last legislative session and kind of what's cooking. There are dollars that we've seen in the past for the wood stove changeout program. So really made a hard press to really advocate for those dollars, because any money we can put towards that means we're not pulling money out of our own budget and it goes to a good cause. I think that'd be really big takeaway. All right.
Also,
yeah.
Briefly, we had a follow-up meeting with our good discussion about so many impacts to our region, and then one of the things that all of us can talk about is
we will be giving a presentation.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you. Any other comments? Okay. Seeing none, we'll move on to our report from the ACCA.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. In engineering, I just wanted to let you know that the Monterey County District Attorney's Office settled a case for asbestos violations related to non-compliant construction activities at the Holman Building in Pacific Grove. So as part of that settlement package, we received $125,000, and that was delivered by the attorney's office just last week. Also, our public comment period reviewed our decision to issue a significant modification to the federal Title V operating permit for Air Energy down South County. Ended on November 15th. We didn't receive any complaints or comments from the public, and with the PA approval, we'll move forward with granting the permit. The kickoff meeting for MBARD's new database system, which is Acela, which is what Monterey County currently has, was held on Tuesday, and we're looking forward to transitioning over to our new database from our old Trackit system. And then we will be meeting with the Monterey County Vintners Association, as well as the Growers Association and the Wine Institute tomorrow at our office. Board members are welcome to attend if you're interested. That's going to be at, I believe, 11 o'clock. 10 or 11. Let me know if you're interested and I'll get you a certain time. We just completed a CEC grant final report. That was for $290,000. And we'll be publishing that soon. This is for evaluating and promoting the development of alternative fuel vehicles in the Monterey Bay region. And this included contracts for ride and drive events, outreach, development of reach codes in cities and counties that go beyond the state requirements for encouraging development of electric vehicle infrastructure, and outreach to owners of medium-duty fleets to evaluate expanding their fleets to electric vehicles. So also on the EV front, phase two of the Monterey Bay Electric Vehicle Incentive Program, this is after Monterey Bay Community Power, is proceeding. To date, we've processed 140 applications. We've obligated well over $115,000, and we've got about $250,000 to $80,000 remaining. So we still have to make a push. I want to get this money expended as soon as possible. So far we're on track that we're doing pretty steady work on that. I want to thank staff for helping to streamline the process, number one, but also to put a lot of time to make sure that the customers are getting their incentive monies on time. There will be a ribbon cutting on December 10th, I think it's around 11:30 at Live Oak School District in Santa Cruz County to celebrate the delivery of two all-electric school buses funded through our zero-emission school bus program. So if you're interested in attending that, please let me know too, and we'll make sure you have an opportunity to speak if you would like. And then as Director McShane mentioned, we've received $175,000 for the wood stove change-out program. That's from state monies. The first year, the state allocated $5 million to the air districts. The second year, $3 million. And we just found out the third year, guess how much? Zero. So we're a little bit concerned because they haven't even gotten any report back to the legislature on how successful or unsuccessful the program is. It's been very successful for us, and so our data will show that there is a need and a demand. So we hope to also partner with the Energy Services Program up in Santa Cruz, as well as Monterey Bay Community Power. Monterey Bay Community Power, as you may know, wants to electrify everything that moves, and including heaters. So it looks like we may be able to offer some additional incentive funding if the state doesn't come up with more money. But we'll be pressing the flesh and talking to our legislators to make sure that money is allocated again, hopefully. San Lorenzo Valley, we haven't called a spare the air alert, although I was up teaching a class at UC Santa Cruz yesterday, and the professor said it was really bad air quality, and then we had some winds come through and blow it out. But it looks like we're settling into our wintertime stagnant air conditions where smoke can hover at ground levels and sort of smoke out all the residents in that area. So we have to be diligent with forecasting, and hopefully we'll get good compliance. We've received a number of letters from the public demanding that we make this a mandatory program, which is very difficult, as you can appreciate, to drive around Santa Cruz to see what type of device people are using in their homes. So we're still looking into that, but for now we hope that if we get enough announcement out about the spare the air alerts, that people think they are mandatory and not voluntary. So and then speaking of San Lorenzo Valley, we have a student art contest, and tonight we'll be at this San Lorenzo Valley School Board meeting, and we'll be awarding the winner of the calendar art contest. And the theme this year was Wood Smoke Affects Us All. So that's going to be really, really fun. That's sponsored by Bruce McPherson's office and the district. And then finally, on a personal note, I have this really nice, I'm very proud to have received this boat anchor in crystal for my, this proves that I actually was co-president of the National Association of Clean Air Agencies, so I thought you guys would like to see it. It's a really nice trophy to have. I was co-president, I represented all the local districts throughout the country, and then my co-president represented the state interests. So I'll be now immediate past president of this august organization, which is going through a lot of changes and difficulties. The best thing I could say when I accepted this in my speech was I didn't do anything really bad under my leadership, and I wasn't impeached either. So I think that was really good news. And then finally, I'll just say that Yes, I'll just say that I've been voted back on the board of directors for the California Air Pollution Control Officers Association. I took 2 years off to mainly work at NACA, and I really miss being on the board because there's a lot of monies coming out of the state, and it's a good opportunity for the district to be involved upfront and personal. Those efforts will continue. I'm just an alternate right now, but I'm promised that will be a full-time thing. And then it's Les is pointing out here that if you do want to attend those meetings, we have to make sure we follow the quorum practices and so forth. So less than a quorum. And I don't know, there's probably a lot of other stuff I could talk about, but I'll let it go. And be happy to answer any questions.
Maybe just a little bit more on the $290,000 grant. So that will also include working with local jurisdictions on EV infrastructure. Is that we had something like that in place before?
So that is. So we've already gone through that grant, and so we're processing the final report on that.
Great.
So yeah, we did some of the ride and drives. That's what funded it. With was it REACH? REACH? Yes. So we hope to, once again, we'll be looking for dollars and feet more. We're trying to get folks to get into their EVs. And I could go off on the whole administration issue, and I will probably be bringing an item to the board next month to talk about after I've had a chance to discuss with legal counsel about some strategies on awarding incentives to those car manufacturers that are not actually suing California. So more to come on that.
Okay. Great. Well, Rich, we want to acknowledge your service at the national level and at the state level. You know, the rural or smaller jurisdictions don't necessarily get the attention of, say, South Coast air quality district and such. So thanks for being that advocate. I know the time away. It's hard to balance the time, so thanks. Okay, so moving on to the consent agenda. Well, we'll start with members of the board. Is there any member of the board that would like to pull an item from the consent agenda? Okay, seeing none, going to the public. Okay, seeing none, is there a motion to approve the consent agenda?
Second.
Moved by Carbone, seconded by Ledesma. Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. So we'll move on to the regular agenda. And we have an opportunity to look at the policies and procedures manual for the Carl Morrow program.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I'll just tee this off, and Hannah will be giving the presentation. And this is something that we do every year to update our Carl Moyer program guidelines. Because of changes in legislation and then things we learn in practice. It seems that this is always being refined and improved. And with help of our legal counsel, Les Gerard, we think we've got even a more improved guidelines. And Hannah will run you through the changes and what to expect for this upcoming year.
All right, perfect. Thank you for the introduction, Rich, there. And good afternoon, members of the board. And staff. Like it said, my name is Hannah Muga. Sorry about my voice. I swallowed a frog. So like he said, I'm going to give you a quick rundown on our CARMOR guidelines, the updates for 2019, as well as just a brief background. Jump right into our guideline changes, as well as some other co-funding opportunities that we have, and program statistics, just to give you an overview of what we've done with the projects. So for those who are new to our board and may not have heard about the CARMOR program before, it's been around since 1998, and the district has participated in since 2001. And it's all about cost-effectively reducing diesel emissions. So we're looking at incentivizing people to switch out their diesel emissions, whether it's engines or the entire tractor, for example, prior to any regulatory compliance deadlines. So it's all surplus. And statewide, there's been about $1 billion to date that's been spent on this program, and that's about $60 million a year. So as I mentioned, it's cleaner than required. Everything is in addition to what then needs to be required by statutory law. We're looking at oxides of nitrogen, reactive organic gases, as well as diesel particulate matter. And behind the Carr Moyer program, when it comes to funding, where is it coming from? It's coming from the smog abatement fee, which is $6 per newly registered vehicle. So that's coming directly from the DMV. The tire fee, which is Assembly Bill 923, and then match funding. So it's always easy to talk about it, but I think pictures say a lot more. So here are just some photos to show what we've done with our program and some of the projects we funded. So here on the left, you'll see one of the old pieces of equipment, which is a 1980 wheel loader that we helped fund. And just to put a price tag on some of this equipment, you probably know some of the backstories with these heavier machines. They're expensive. So this is a good example of, we funded this for $300,000. The new piece of equipment was close to $600,000. So this is just one example of what these dollars are doing. Another industry we focus on is marine. So marine vessels, we do a lot of engine repowers. This is kind of the jewel of the bay for the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute in Bari. We worked with the Rachel Carson, pictured there up in the top left, and we helped them fund the replacement of two of their propulsion engines. And they replaced 1997 engines. For everybody driving consistently through the valley, you're all aware that we have plenty of tractors in our valley. This is just one of the big examples of, we have a lot of quad tracks that are roaming around. So here on the left, we have a 2010 replaced with a 2019 model. This was a recent project with Paro Valley, laser leveling, and as you all know, ag pumps, something has to, the water comes from somewhere. So we do a lot of diesel engine replacements when it comes to ag pumps. And this one is a complete electrification project. So we help fund the electric motor, the VFD, as well as part of the lines that are needed for PGE. So let's get down to the update. As I kind of showed with all the photos, we've been focusing on diesel to diesel, but also diesel to electric whenever possible. But the 2011 and 2017 guidelines allowed us to go look at marine vessel repowers, electrification projects when it comes to ag pumps, and then off-road equipment replacement. Now, with this new advent of everything is being electrified, we really wanted to also include that in our guidelines, so we have opportunities with the Carr Moyer program. And so we added some categories, which being here, the biggest thing for us is, I think, opening up our projects to on-road. So, and specifically zero emissions. We'd like to focus on pushing zero emissions. So we added a zero emission on-road category, infrastructure. So Steve, that's kind of your question too. This might be another avenue. And school buses. So we have a school bus program already, but we also, on top of that, wanted to help school district find funding. Some other noteworthy changes. So we have, like I mentioned, several different funding sources that we can co-fund projects with. And we thought that it was really essential that we have a standard when it comes to how do we evaluate projects that's across the board. So there's no questions about how we select projects to be funded. And a lot of the funding from cap and trade dollars focus on disadvantaged communities. So we, our standard is, we're going to go with disadvantaged communities first, low-income areas, then focus on zero-emission projects. And if none of the other apply, annual emissions reduced, just like we've done in the past. One of the big things for us is we added a note in our guidelines that gives us the ability to deny any applications for applicants who have violated any district rules and regulations, as well as who are not following the local, regional, or state or federal regulations. So being very strict and clear with that language in our guidelines, I think, is very important. Another thing is, with our destruction methodology, in the past, people have been able to destroy their equipment on site at their yards. Now we would like to have more standardization in how that is completed. So we are asking, our requirement is that destruction will be done at a verified salvage yard. So all equipment will need to go to a salvage yard, and that's the final destination. And then I think the biggest opportunities will be on road. I think with the bus and truck regulation kicking in, especially for, well, in our area, it's, everybody will be affected by 2023. So this will really allow people to take advantage of the program if they so choose to apply. So as I mentioned, there are several funding sources that we can co-fund under the Carl Moyer guidelines. And that diagram just gives you an idea of all the different various funding sources that we are receiving to date. So the Carl Moyer guidelines kind of spread and crawl throughout other grant funds as well. For example, the Farmer Program also looks at Moyer for guidance. The CAP, which is the Community Air Protection Grant, also uses parts of the Carl Moyer guidelines. And then we have State Reserve, we have the Voluntary NOx Remediation Grant, East Garrison, just to name a few, as well as local contributions, mitigations, etc. So I think when it comes to us as staff, it's really important that in order to do something like this, where you co-fund with various sources, it comes down to when you have a project, that project has to fit all the requirements of all the different funding sources. So that's up to us. We really need to do a diligent job there. But it allows us to go much further with our funding sources. All right, so wanted to throw in some colors. It's a little overwhelming, but in 2017, Cal EPA came out with a screening tool that assessed every census tract in California, and it's based on the pollution burden. And so this is being used to help people like us at the air district level staff to evaluate whether or not a project falls into disadvantaged communities or low-income areas. So even though I think everybody's eyes are always attracted to the red is not good, so maybe that's good if you know, it draws you to it. So red means that on the right there's a percentage. So it's in the 91 to 100% most impacted, most burdened communities. So yeah, and a lot of the money that's being distributed, allocated to air districts, is focused on really helping those disadvantaged and low-income areas. So as you can see with our area, you have the Bay there, you have Santa Cruz County, San Benito, and Monterey County. There's not a lot of red, which is good, right? But there definitely are some areas that still qualify under the CAP program. So priority areas. For us, it's the for disadvantaged communities, we're looking at the top 25% of the most impacted census tracts through the Cal Enviro Screen Tool 3.0, and low-income areas. So that's census tract and household that are at or below 80% of the statewide median income level. So to help with that very distracting, very colorful map, further simplified the map. And here we have all those areas in our area, in our region. So the three counties, blue is low-income areas, red are the disadvantaged communities, and you can see slivers of orange, which indicate the half-mile buffer zone between those two. Which so this is what the priority areas that we will be focusing most of our funding to. So when we receive applications, when we look at where most of the equipment is being operated, if it falls within any of these areas, disadvantaged communities first, low-income areas, etc. So this really helps make our job much easier, but also efficient. So what have we done with our program so far? So just some funding history. The Carl Moyer program historically has seen around 600, 700. And then the last 5 years, it's been kind of steadily increasing. So 800,000 starting from fiscal year 14-15, 15-16 was just about the same. But then in the last 2 years, we really saw an increase in funding. So this is just focused on Carmore. So this graph just shows Moyer, Carmore interest, as well as match and state reserve. So now, I mentioned other funding sources, so throw in Farmer and CAP, we see this kind of a representation of how much our program has actually grown. So the last 2 years, actually this year, our grant funding amount has quadrupled from 5 years ago, which is kind of, it's fundamentally changed how we run things because we've had, you know, with similar staff, we've really had to hone in on being efficient as possible and still trying to do other duties on the job. So this is, it kind of speaks for our program that it's really improved. Here's another chart, just the same data for those who are figure driven. Here we have the money, and this just kind of gives another idea of, okay, for year 2014-15, 15-16, and fiscal year 16-17, we really only received more and more interest and match. And then the last 2 years, we've received a lot more from the state in various grant funding. Another map to show where our projects have fallen. So over 18 years, we've spent $17 million in grant funding. We've done 182 projects. These are being represented by the dots on the map. Some of them, it's not 182 right there on the map. It doesn't do it justice because, as you know, the harbors, they're very select small areas. So you'll see in a second when you zoom in on specific areas, we actually did a lot more projects in those areas than are visible here on this map. We've reduced almost 4,000 tons of emissions. And that's through ag pump projects, 45 ag pump projects. We did 66 tractor and off-road replacements, 70 marine engine repowers, and we actually did do one on-road project. So that's pretty good and speaks well for our program and consistent efforts in reducing emissions. So here's one more example. These are just our three ports or harbors, Moss Landing. We really touched a lot of vessels, so this program did something for, I think all of us can be proud for using the money wisely, and it's gone to various businesses and done its part. So I think that gives a good summary, and I'm open to any questions you might have.
Sure. Questions?
I would just like to recognize Hannah for all of her work, and she's really improved this project greatly. She's got the GIS skills, as you've seen, with map making and so forth. And I feel really comfortable that the program is now in her capable hands. And I expect great things going forward, too. So you may ask yourselves some of the questions, why are we having the ability to deny applications, and why are we making folks go through more rigorous destruction protocols? And it's just like everything else. 1 year we had somebody sink one of their vessels and salvage their brand new diesel engine. We didn't think of that. And so now we have a lien on the vessel, so if something like that happens, we can go after them. Well, we found out this year we have somebody that destroyed their vessel or their tractor engine by drilling a huge hole through the block. And then we found it later on operating with the hole welded shut. So that sort of defeats the purpose. And we had actually no way to deal with that person aside from some legal avenues and so forth. But if something like that happens going forward, we definitely don't want to have them apply again for another project and not be able to deny them. So those are a couple of the changes along with the changes in state law that allow or guidelines that allow us to modify our program as well.
Maybe just one question, Hannah, as to the process of engaging the public or some of the traditional applicants as it relates to these changes, certainly the expanded scope of what we're looking at. What's the plan?
So I think that's a really good question. We definitely have we have our workshop that's every January right before our application phase opens. So I would highly encourage people that you know of, if they're not already on our list, to subscribe or send me an email. We do outreach to the people that we already have on file. But if there's more, I'm sure there are more businesses that we just haven't even heard of, especially now with the on-road sector. We also will rely on some of our other programs. So like you know, Alan does a lot with electric vehicles. So we have contacts there already. And so we're going to include them on all our email, emails that are going out.
There's a flyer or some announcement you could send that board member, make sure we can pass it on as well.
Perfect.
So just so the board's aware, though, I don't want to create expectations that we may not be able to meet. One of the things we did when we saw a lot of this extra funding is typically the Carl Moyer program is really oversubscribed by almost an order of magnitude. So we just took that list and went down the list, and we were able to, in the case of Farmer, that's for ag equipment. Well, a lot of our Moyer projects are ag equipment, and they use the same guidelines. So we were able to take and fulfill those requests from people that were on the waiting list. So, we didn't really have extra money to advertise so much as to just fulfill the waiting list that we already had established. But in subsequent years, that definitely will be the case, and we want to make sure that the word gets up. We'll make sure the board gets the announcements.
So just so you know, the blue basically stretches all the way to the southernmost county. Yeah.
And one of the reasons I was wondering now is looking at the colors in that blue.
Yep. The other one?
I wonder only if there's a real thing that we're doing now. People are modeling the same perspective as the people who are talking about the first thing.
Oh. So I'd love to get in contact with you about this because you're on point, because we know, for example, if we were to zoom in on that blue by Santa Cruz, that includes the Santa Cruz Yacht Club. There is no reason why that should be included, but it's a census tract, so the census might actually, the track boundary might span much further. But we're obligated to use this tool, and I've brought this up to the state, the ARB, many times, that for some of our regions, it's not consistent with what we know is actually there. And their only thing is, well, you could look at environmental justice, but for us, we're a small district in their books, and small districts do not have to do that. So, and when you do that, you have to basically produce a full policy of how are you evaluating environmental justice. And I don't think that still, this tool is very useful, but like you said, it's just, it has some gaps and inaccuracies. So, but knowing that, maybe I can convey that information to our liaisons and they can spread that information and knowledge. So I appreciate that. And Steve, I wanted to say for outreach, if there are any events, because for CAP, we're obligated to do extra outreach. If there are any specific events that you or any of the board members are aware of that you'd like us to, I don't want to predict our division, but it would be good to know of the events.
Yeah, sure. I'd just like to do the same thing with Tahoe in last moment, because he and I are always traveling back and forth.
Okay.
Going south and north, But, and we do have a big, besides a lot of other things, a big traffic problem. And I just had the sheriff go and take a picture at night for us, showing how the traffic's all backed up, and you just have all the pollution, all the come down from Swing Road, and so
Fantastic.
If I could just add, this is a classic race to the bottom. You know, ever since Cal EnviroScreen came out, I remember the day when, you know, you were loath to say anything about a community being disadvantaged, because then you would be affecting housing rates and market rates and all that. And now everybody wants to have red. So when Hannah says it's good we don't have red, it is sort of good, but I should also say there's like 16 parameters in Cal EnviroScreen. Some of them are pollution, such as pesticides, but some of them are socioeconomic factors, such as income and level of education, that sort of thing. And then undocumented, by definition, undocumented folks don't really make it onto the list. And I can say that in the Santa Cruz area, they were not using our air quality data from the San Lorenzo Valley. So hopefully that'll be included in the future. But yeah, it's been a problem. But the good news is low-income area is one of our priority areas, so we can apply the funds towards those areas.
Great. Any other questions yet?
I would just say thank you for focusing on disadvantaged communities, no matter how they're delineated. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Incredible. Thank you. Okay, so we'll move on to the next agenda item if there's no other questions. I can't recall if I opened it up to the public. This is just an information item. Is there any member of the public that would like to comment on this item? Okay. Seeing none, we'll move on to... Is it? I'm sorry. You're right. It is an action item. Okay. So seeing no comments from the public, is there a motion?
I'll move the recommended action.
Okay. Second. Moved by Friend, seconded by Phillips. All those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, same sign. Okay. Motion carries. Thank you for catching that hand. Sorry. I thought it was an information item. Okay. So we'll move on to our presentation. So Amy.
So good afternoon, directors. I will be here to talk about the public safety power shutoffs and how they've impacted in air quality. And I don't know about you, but I actually didn't even think that they would actually do that. When they first talked about it, I thought, how could they turn off power to that many people? But it turns out I was way wrong, and they did it. And so really the whole reason behind this is that the state-owned, investor-owned utilities were given this ability to try to reduce the risk to wildfires. And nobody wants to wake up in San Francisco and see that out their window. And not only the impact to air quality, but the impact to land, people's homes, property. It's really, it's devastating. And so that's why we've now come to this place where PG&E can turn the power off. And the thing about smoke is that you just don't ever know where it's gonna go. This was the Thomas Fire in 2017, and it's kind of hard to see from the satellite image the way it was taken, but the smoke basically went out over the ocean and swirled back around and hit Santa Cruz. And that same fire, you can see the smoke traveled right up the coast, right up the state. And so smoke from wildfires is devastating and impacts our quality across the state, no matter where the fire is, because it depends on the meteorological conditions at the time. The utilities decided that public safety power shutoffs was one way that they could try to minimize those impacts. And the ironic thing is that one of the ways that they really push for people to get information is to turn in their cell phone number and they'll text you updates. It's really hard to get an update if your cell phone doesn't work with your cell phone tower. Power's turned off. So the first PSPS occurred on October 9th, and what we experienced at the Air District was, what Director Lopez mentioned was, this was rush. I need a generator. People kind of freaking out. I have no power. What am I supposed to do? So I'm going to focus on talking about portable generators, and those are typically some sort of a skid or platform so they can be moved from location to location, and it's something that somebody would rent. The other is a stationary engine, which is usually affixed to a foundation and just stays at one location. So I'm not really going to focus on that. Any stationary engine over 50 horsepower would need an air district permit. But portable engines are really what people seem to be running to in this event. And what we found was there's no inventory. of registered engines. There's a statewide registration program for generators, and the inventory was non-existent. And so there is a provision in the state law that allows people to bring in unregistered engines from out of state. They have to meet certain requirements. They have to turn in a special form, but it is allowed during an emergency event. And this is in the state law for use of portable engines that the California Air Resources Board determined that a PSPS meets the definition of an emergency event. It's an other unforeseen event. The difficult part about that is that it's saying that you're operating these engines to help alleviate a threat to public health and safety. And so that's where it can become a little difficult for us as an air district to decide, well, is power out at the gas station a threat to public health and safety? You could argue it both ways. Yes, people need gas to get in their car to leave the area, or there's no other grocery store in 50 miles and people need food, and so they go to the store at the gas station, so they need power. So I think for this year, it is an unforeseen event that PG&E is turning the power off. I think next year and the following years, if this continues, it will be more difficult for us to call this an unforeseen event because it's something that now is something that's a routine that the utilities are doing every fall. So for now, we will be considering these as emergency events, but I anticipate that changing. So this is just, you know, a gas station, but in the shop, you can see there, no power, can't sell gas, can't sell anything in the store. So this is where it's difficult to decide whether or not that's really a threat to public health and safety if they don't have power. But what we also found is that there's lots of different kinds of sources that lose power. Landfills, Johnson Canyon had no power at the landfill. Wineries had no power. So then there's also businesses, restaurants. Some of our inspectors observed restaurants that went and got portable engines, and it can cost several $100 just to hook up that engine. So they're not likely to want to remove that engine until they're sure that there aren't going to be any more PSPS events. So portable engines can only stay at one location for less than 12 months. So we're anticipating that these places that have these engines we're going to have to make sure that they only keep them there for 12 months. Because there's this reduced inventory of state registered engines, we're seeing an influx of these engines from out of state. And so the other thing that happens, as I mentioned, when the power goes out, cell phone towers go out. Now all the cell phone companies are trying to find generators. The other part of that, though, is they need fuel to operate. And so there was also this, since some of these events were multiple day, they were having to go to the gas station to get diesel because the normal diesel delivery wasn't available. They were too busy doing other deliveries. And so it's another reason why maybe the gas station needs power is to give the diesel some of these backup generators. So it's interesting how it all has been connected. But anytime the power goes out and if you don't have fuel for your engine, you still don't have backup power. The other thing is when the power goes out, the air monitors don't work. So we don't know what the air quality is like. So you can't go on your phone, you can't get the updates, you can't go on your computer, get an update, you can't find out what the air quality is. You have to just use your common sense, and if it's smoky, because there's a wildfire, you probably should leave the area. So the other part of this was that the governor issued a state of emergency, and there was a provision in there that said the Air Resources Board, and I think that would also mean that it trickles down to the Air District, that we're to maximize our, I don't know why it said maximum, but that's what it said maximum discretion, streamlined permitting, allowing generators to operate during the state of emergency. Then there was also some funding included in the budget, and it could be used for equipment such as generators. So we're anticipating that it's possible that cities or counties, government agencies may come to us to apply for backup generators. We did see some, like water districts, they have pumps. Got to keep the water flowing. So we have seen some emergency generators permitted. Those are stationary at those types of locations. So we realize in the short term that having these portable engines out there is something that we're going to need to allow. But long term, if it's a stationary source, like a landfill or a winery, and they're going to have a portable engine, they're going to need to get a permit for that so they can have it at their facility. Or I'm anticipating what's probably going to happen is they're just going to get a stationary engine that's going to be affixed on a foundation at that location. So we're anticipating probably over the next year that we're going to see more generators getting permitted. And this is a concern for air districts because those engines now require maintenance, so they're turned on every month. And so now we're getting additional, if they're diesel particulate matter into the atmosphere, which isn't really what we would like. And so the air district and the California Air Resources Board are gonna work together to try to come up with some calculations about what the air quality impacts could be from additional generators and try to steer people towards cleaner alternatives, whether that might be natural gas or propane or some type of alternative technology to try to minimize the impact of having an influx of generators permitted across the state. So we'll see. We're also going to be working on an advisory to help explain the situation with portable engines. And the California Air Resources Board came out with a guidance document, and they're going to incorporate all of the air districts. There's different ways that the districts may handle permitting of these portable generators. So there'll be an additional document coming out to help explain that, because everybody's getting lots of calls about this, I think, across the state. So that, I'll take any questions.
Questions?
Thanks, Amy, for this. My district went dark twice. It's wonderful. I might recommend it for everybody. Because everybody seems to really fix everything, so I can just listen to nobody gets their GPME. So. But a lot of people that use personal generators, following Amazon, it's really telling. I didn't realize the amount of these things on the social media. It would be really useful to have the information as whether there's upticks during your time to see the first. There's a lot of effort behind the scenes to deal with PG&E, with the consortium of electives and the Greater Bay Area that are working on working with PG&E to the system out of the public energy facility. And into more of a microgrid system to take them out of But the way to just would be another way to do it would be able to make it by when the CPC the air quality standard. So anything that you could provide you can come back and have a willing system to be able to show that there's an uptake. But I mean I think realistically we're creating a situation where people that seem to be doing down their own homes in order to find power for PSP for their kids or whatever it is, but because they don't even know how to use it. And they're not going to be registered, you're not going to know they're there, but it would be useful with air monitoring to just know whether there's an uptake at all, particularly during the day, because that's kind of the key to it.
Director Botello?
Yeah, I just hope that, that we do maximum discretion. The economic impact on businesses that's been devastating to be shut down, besides, families that were out for days. And, I think PG&E is learning a lot as far as how to shut the grid off, where and how, and this is not going to go away anytime soon, I don't think. But hopefully it will be more efficient going into the future. And you have to have a little bit of flexibility, too. So we have a little bit of a drop-off on air quality, which is different generators being used in different sizes. But,
any other comments? Okay.
I would just also maybe dovetail on what Anthony said, that
you know, my mom would always tell me this, hey, mijo, when you're going to go feed your family, you really don't care about anything else but feeding your family. So you have a lot of small merchants and just in attest to this in South Monterey County and Santa Cruz that their whole livelihood depends on being open Saturday, Sunday, right? And PG&E, in their great wisdom, instead of closing down on Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday, the slowest business days of the year, close down on Saturday evening, a small merchant's busiest time, Sunday all day. The majority of the Latino community makes their money on Saturday night and Sunday. And what does PG&E do? We're going to close you down on those 2 days, right? And it's not fair to the merchant that, you know, so we're going to complain about having a generator on when the guy's like, dude, I've got $2,000 of meat in my food. And you're going to care about how much pollution? I don't really care. I mean, I was in that circumstance. I own a little wine barn, and for me, it's not that big of a deal, right? Because I've had another life before this. But if I was a merchant, that was my livelihood, I really wouldn't care about your air right now, because I've got to feed my family, and you're going to be worried about the air. It's, somebody needs to kind of send that to PG&E, that this is ridiculous. They have so little foresight on what they're doing. Like, the smart thing would have been done, tell people 48 hours ahead, hey, we're going to have to shut you off, and we will try to make the economic impact as small as possible. So we're going to close it down on Monday. Most restaurants are closed on Monday. Most grocery stores are slow on Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday. But definitely not Saturday night. So in South Monterey County, they closed Gonzales down at 3. They closed Soledad down at 8. And we didn't get power again till Monday at 5 o'clock, 4:30. Right? So I talked to the local merchants, and they were just like, dude, I just can't believe this. I would ask that maybe we could convey that also to PG&E, just to send that message. They're not very smart about it. I just wonder. I'm going to apply for a job at PG&E because it doesn't take much to get.
They might go away, though. Director Friend just said they're becoming public.
I'm sorry. Good.
So I was just going to say, you know, right, the biggest challenge I have with the entire process is that I'm not a lot of studies. So we were able to get in touch with a lot of folks in the industry, and stuff to rip with the people not understanding. We call wineries, and they shut off. Then we call the people in the pharmacy, they call the truck drivers, and all of that reverberates into the economy. So I have people who lost 3 or 4 days of work not knowing if they were going to shut off or not, but they were going to call the truth that they were not working for the year, and well, you know, I think it's covered for those, but that's true for the year, it's not for the year. When I think about what I saw during that period, I'm very fortunate. I was alive. I'm across the street, the farm across the road, it was on the side. So I was looking out over Soledad, and I watched the lights shut off. And my wife and I were sitting there talking about, well, what happened next? We woke up in the morning, and there was a more smoke in the city, and I didn't get out. But what we noticed was it's coming from the fire station, and it was really good. And all of our neighbors were good. The impact to our community is wider than most folks can see, but one day looking at expenses and house and challenges and stuff, we explain to the community why. Looking back, why did Soledad and stuff not do it, and they're coming out and people with it. So my dream, and I said this on the conference call, my dream for the 45 years, is telling me that we need to be better down here, or we're going to get it all around us. And my hills are ours. Everybody in Mission Soledad, most folks in Mission Soledad, or as they go up in the mountains, they've got power. But the folks down on the floor and the police, lost that complaint. It's inundated. I think that's exactly trying to find some way of modernizing this and looking down the way of action. So as we look at the question that falls in front of this board of the generators, I think we're going to see a lot more of this one. And I think what my concern is, are we going to be applying rules that don't take into account the cost of energy, making these investments? Some of those companies are going to be lost millions of dollars, and they're going to be making investments in their own infrastructure and people that are taking on the task. But we want to make sure we're not onerous, we're not making, well, we're applying it to visiting, operating, and using it every single day, knowing that we only need to make investments to try to get people growth.
$600,000 to run the cooler, where if they don't run the cooler, the cost of emptying the cooler, decontaminating the cooler, not running the cooler for another 4 to 5 days during the process, can be $1 million to run it.
I will say our rules do, so emergency standby generators do have a higher emission limit, so they can be tier 2 or tier 3, whereas a prime engine, which is the kind of engine that's run all the time, those have to be a tier 4, which is the highest emission standard. So there are some, there already is some ability for us in our rules to permit stationary engines at a lower emission, or I guess high emission.
Great, yeah.
Yes.
Hi. On what Chris was saying, we were on those calls, and we were seeing the PG knew what they were doing. But then we get on the call again, and they were apologetic for not knowing very much. You know, they changed the central location from Aromas out to somewhere in San Bernardino County. We figured they knew what they were doing, and they find out, they said, well, the reason we did that was we couldn't figure out who to contact at the Aroma Springs. I said, all you have to do is call someone. You know what I mean? But that's why they changed it. We assumed they had some strategic reasons behind it. But I got to say, when we went through and we were out of power a year and a half ago when we had the big storm and it went in Tundra, I mean, when you're out of power, there are no rules. You know, so you can't blame people. I mean, it's like Prunedale back in the old days. You go and you take care of your family. So we were getting, I was getting generators from people I knew, getting them to people that were in a bad spot. But when you're out of power, they got to resort to something. You can't blame people for you know, going to Amazon and getting 100 generators. And I think most people, a lot of people are going to keep those as reserves.
So I've heard the board. I just want to reassure the board that I've already directed staff that we are going to employ maximum flexibility when it comes to these engines. I don't want to be in between, you know, somebody being operated on and there's no power, and we're going to say, stand there and say it's got to meet air quality requirements. However, and I'll just have this caveat, if state law and the state is enforcing it, I can't turn a blind eye to that. So it's going to happen at the state level for some of these. And I think the real solution is this is turning into a third world country if we can't rely on electricity. I understand that even after the power went out, the fire started up in this last one up in Sonoma. So, you know, it's a problem that needs to be addressed. It's, and we're not going to be on the front lines for this. Except the public's going to start calling us when there are, I'll tell you, before air quality, it's going to be noise. My neighbor's running their thing. I can't sleep. They're watching TV. And then we're not going to enforce on these little generators. So we're talking more than 50 horsepower. So it's going to be good for Home Depot, I'll tell you that. But for us, it is going to be a problem. But we're going to work with folks and make sure they get the best equipment that's available currently. But we're not going to, you know, keep them to the letter of the law unless it's the state's come out and said you have to. So.
Very relevant topic. Other topics?
I just have a question in regards to water and sewer. If power were to go out, I believe that they're set up with emergency generators. Is there an exemption? For those companies, so water, sewer, I serve on the one water board, and we found this discussion that came up, and we have found out they do have generators, but there are a few or a couple cities that do not have generators to their pump stations.
So that's up to them to be able to get the generators. As I said, we're not going to stand in the way. That is an essential public service. However, I will say as a result of this, it's good for our business in a way, because a lot of water districts and sewage treatment districts, we found engines that we didn't know were there previously. And they're starting to ask questions like, do these need to be registered since like 20 years ago? And we're like, yeah, they do. So once again, we're going to work with them to make sure they get the latest technology when they can afford or when it's available and the inventory's up. But we're not going to ding them or try to be onerous on them. But that is a concern. That the other thing I'll just say, that even though emergency generators, they're not going to be they have to be operated routinely. And most have requirements for so many, like 50 hours a year. They have to be in operation to demonstrate that they're reliable. So it's not just you turn them on whenever you need it. You have to test them monthly to make sure they're going to work when you do need them. So we have, you know, diesel particulate is a carcinogen, and I can see the public calling in. Just try to imagine Monterey downtown or downtown Santa Cruz, all the restaurants bring in 100 to 500 horsepower diesel engine. It would be a cacophonous sound. I can't imagine it would be a very nice place to dine. And then you would have odors as well as toxic fumes to breathe in. So something has to be done that's not going to be at this level.
Thank you.
Does anybody need a generator?
Is that right?
I'll just one last comment real quick. Hey, you know what was the funniest thing, being in the dark for 2.5 days? It wasn't the darkness, it was the silence. I was blown away how quiet things were, right? I don't know if that's background noise and lights or what. No, really, it was like deathly silent, right? Like kind of crazy, like you were out in the wilderness. It was kind of cool, really.
Like having the power off.
Yeah.
Perfect time of presentation. Thank you very much, Amy. With that, our next meeting is set for December the 18th. We'll go ahead and adjourn. Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care of yourself. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
That's true. Well, there's a good joke I heard. So this guy.